From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! To most politicians, this is an easy chair. That's a full-page ad running today calling for a moratorium on the death penalty. We'll speak with Chicago Congressmember Jesse Jackson Jr. Also, a look at the first Ibero-American summit in Havana as Cuba sues the U.S. for its crippling trade embargo, and victims of the Bhopal disaster sue Union Carbide for indifference to human life. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. One of the youngest murder defendants in U.S. history was convicted of second-degree murder yesterday for shooting a stranger outside a convenience store with a rifle when he was 11. In a case that has stirred fierce debate over how to treat young offenders, Nathaniel Abraham sat expressionless and looked straight ahead as the jury announced its verdict after 18 hours of deliberations over 4 days. Nathaniel was acquitted of first-degree murder, which could have sent him to prison for life with no chance of parole. At his sentencing December 14th, he could get a maximum of life in prison with a chance of parole, or he could be sentenced as a juvenile to time already served or held until his 21st birthday. Prosecutors say they'll recommend a blended sentence, keeping him imprisoned until at least 21, and then reviewing his case to determine whether he has been rehabilitated. This news from Jasper. The third white man accused of dragging a black man to death told jurors that he tried to stop the attack but was scared of what his friends might do to him if he didn't go along. Sean Allen Berry's 4 hours on the stand wrapped up the defense's case. Prosecutors are expected to finish their rebuttal case against Berry today, with closing arguments from both sides to follow. Judge Joe Bob Golden instructed jurors to bring overnight bags to today's session with the expectation they'll be sequestered. After a hard-fought campaign to pay off part of its debt to the United Nations, the United States may face an even tougher battle selling the deal's conditions to UN members and resurrecting its tarnished reputation in the organization. Secretary General Kofi Annan and other UN officials and ambassadors welcomed the deal yesterday, saying it was a good step forward that would prevent the world's most powerful country from losing its vote in the General Assembly. Nevertheless, the United Nations and many of its 187 states are deeply resentful that the U.S. has been a deadbeat for so long. And some say the deal reached Sunday night is a slap in the face because it would only pay about half of what Washington owes while attaching conditions the United States would never let any other country impose on the organization. Those conditions involve overseas funding for activities related to abortion. This news from Beijing. Gathering furtively before police could catch them, several members of the banned Falun Gong spiritual movement staged a brief protest today in Tiananmen Square. In the latest act of defiance against the government's 4-month campaign to vanquish the group, 4 women, a man, and a young child performed slow meditation exercises on the vast square's pavement. Plainclothes and uniformed police quickly hustled them into a van and drove them away. Since banning the popular group in July as a threat to society and the regime, the government has ordered millions of believers to renounce their beliefs or face arrest. But followers have converged on the Capitol to appeal, arguing that Falun Gong is not a threat and improves health and morality. The United Nations has taken its first step to implement a peace accord in Congo, but both the rebels and the mediator of the pact say it may be too little, too late to stave off a return to war. A 12-member UN logistical team started a tour of rebel-held cities last week to prepare the way for deployment of thousands of UN peacekeepers called for in the 2-month-old accord brokered by Zambian President Frederick Chiluba under the auspices of the Organization of African Unity. This news from Decatur, Illinois. The deadlock over the expulsion of students following a brawl at a football game lives on despite protests, prayer vigils, and the arrest of the Reverend Jesse Jackson. hours after he was released from jail following his arrest yesterday. Jackson said he was canceling his schedule for the week to remain in Decatur. He planned to lead a prayer vigil outside MacArthur High School today and another protest march on Sunday. He also said a lawsuit will allege that school officials violated privacy laws by disclosing how many days of school the expelled students had missed. Six students were expelled after allegedly taking part in a brawl at a football game September 17th. A seventh withdrew from school during expulsion hearings. Three of the seven also faced criminal charges in the incident. Georgia Baptists have, for the first time in their 177-year history, expelled churches, taking the step against two congregations because they have gay leaders. At the close of their annual convention yesterday, delegates voted overwhelmingly to expel Oakhurst Baptist of Decatur and Virginia Highland Baptist of Atlanta. Both have gay deacons, and Oakhurst has a gay assistant pastor. That's some of the news. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners. And the situation in Vieques that we've been reporting on off and on now for months seems to be reaching a climax. I reported in today's New York Daily News, that Secretary Cohen will be recommending to President Clinton either today or by latest tomorrow that nearly more than 50 years of Navy live bombing exercises in Vieques be ended, and that the Navy pull out of Vieques within 5 years, no later than 5 years. But the Secretary of Defense will be recommending that maneuvers on Vieques continue during that period with using inert munitions, and this still is sure to rile many Puerto Rican leaders who want the Navy completely out of Vieques, and it looks that within the next week or two, the president will probably announce that he supports these recommendations within the next few days, and then that will set the stage for possible mass arrests on Vieques.
What is the governor saying, Rocio?
Well, the governor first asked, he had a couple of conversations, I'm told, with President Clinton over the weekend and on Monday night by telephone, and then at first offered, without saying what it was that was likely to be presented, offered to hold a referendum among the people of Vieques on the alternatives that the U.S. government was offering, but then withdrew that proposal when he encountered tremendous opposition within his own party and within the civic leadership in Puerto Rico. So at this stage, because Puerto Rico is confronted with another immediate crisis, which is Hurricane Lenny hitting the island, the governor has said as soon as the government deals with the hurricane, then he will be able to respond to whatever President Clinton offers.
There's another major issue going on in Puerto Rico of national significance, Juan, and that's the union organizing drives that have been going on and votes taking place there.
Well, yes, there's hundreds of thousands of Puerto Rican government workers are deciding this year and in next year to affiliate to various AFL-CIO unions. And just last week, the teachers of Puerto Rico, I think 25,000 teachers, voted to affiliate to the AFT, which would make
the American
Federation of Teachers, which would make the Puerto Rico chapter of the American Federation of Teachers the second largest in the teachers union after the New York City chapter. And this is as a result of an agreement that was reached several years ago between the AFL-CIO and the government of Puerto Rico that the government would not object to or oppose unionization efforts. So there's a huge organizing drive going on in Puerto Rico by the AFL-CIO to recruit thousands and thousands of new members to the Federation.
This is the largest in the country, organizing drive of the AFL-CIO?
Well, when you add up all of the different unions involved. Yes, the UAW, for instance, just won the right to represent 10,000 cafeteria workers in the Puerto Rico public schools. But when you add up all the government agencies, yes, it's probably the biggest drive, unionization drive, since the 1930s for the AFL.
Well, tomorrow in Chicago, the Food and Drug Administration is going to be holding the first of three public hearings to explain its increasingly controversial policy governing genetically modified food. I'm looking at a front page piece in the Christian Science Monitor today, headlined U.S. Poised for a Biotech Food Fight. And it starts off with a farmer saying he doesn't understand why people are criticizing GM foods like corn and soybeans, saying he's using less pesticide and it's just much easier to maintain his fields. At the same time, it quotes a biologist, Lincoln Brower, who is extremely concerned about high-tech farming. He sees a potential for unexpected threats to the world's rich biodiversity that's best reflected in the monarch butterfly, which can die from contact with pollen from the genetically engineered corn. And the scientist says, I see the monarch as the canary in the coal mine, warning us that there's a bigger problem. Now, these are the two sides, the Christian Science Monitor reporter writes, in the debate over genetically modified food, which is gaining ground on American soil as environmentalists and the biotech industry begin a pitch battle to win over public opinion. And Juan, when you were last here, we were talking about the massive biotech company PR campaign that they've now launched in the United States. This follows the campaigns that they have been running throughout Europe.
Yes, well, if the farmer sees no problem with his product, then I'm sure he'll see no problem with it being labeled genetically engineered, which I think is the least that you can do for the consumer that is that it happens to buy one of these products.
Meanwhile, countries around the world, more than 130 of them, are gearing up for the World Trade Organization ministerial meeting in Seattle. We're also gearing up. Juan and I and the whole Democracy Now! Team will be out in Seattle for the week covering both the meeting of the World Trade Organization country ministers, as well as the tens of thousands of activists who are out there who are going to be dealing with issues of environmental, human rights, labor rights issues to deal with the increasingly globalized economy.
Yes, because the World Trade Organization has succeeded in doing something that no one else has done before. It has created an international people's movement, and the first demonstration of that international people's movement will be in Seattle. In a couple of weeks.
It'll be a major showdown, and also very interesting to see whether the mainstream media will be there with cameras simply showing tens of thousands of people screaming or actually honing in with their microphones and hearing what those protesters have to say. And finally, in this little news of the week wrap-up, Juan, Venezuela, interesting things are happening there as part of the global economy.
Yes, and I'm sure there will be paying more attention to it, but Venezuela is now going through a constitutional convention process to rewriting the constitution of the nation, and it already has many people in Washington worried, because among the reforms that the constitutional convention that was elected after the Hugo Chavez became president are reforms such as reducing the Venezuelan work week, the legal work week, from 48 hours to 40 hours a week. That's an amazing revolution right there. And also, the Constitutional Convention is apparently going to approve a law that would ban the privatization of the Venezuelan oil industry. And, of course, Venezuela is the largest supplier of petroleum to the United States. And there will be many, I'm sure, on Wall Street that are upset about not being banned from being able to get a chunk of the Venezuelan oil industry. So that these reforms, if this constitutional convention continues to develop these radical reforms from the perspective of the United States, I wouldn't be surprised if pretty soon we see a new movement to destabilize and overthrow the government of Venezuela.
And Juan, next we're together on Friday. I'll be broadcasting from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. You'll be here in New York. And then I'm headed to Fort Benning, Georgia, to Columbus, Georgia, where the largest mobilization ever is expected to take place this weekend, between 5 and 10,000 people calling for the closing of the School of the Americas. Tomorrow we'll be speaking with Father Roy Bourgeois, who is the man who has led this movement that has, to say the least, grown by leaps and bounds. And speaking of leaps, on Sunday, thousands will make a major leap over the line into the Fort Benning base, and a number of people expect to be arrested. Among those, the actor Martin Sheen, who has done many of these acts of conscience, even as he plays the President of the United States on NBC's West Wing on Wednesday nights. But speaking of Latin America, we're going to turn now to Cuba. Leaders of Latin American countries, Portugal and Spain, yesterday held the one-day Ibero-American summit in Havana. It's the first to be held on the island of Cuba. Central to the talks were discussions on the dangers of globalization for developing countries, as well as a debate over extraterritoriality sparked by Chile and Argentina's decision to boycott the summit to protest the arrest in London of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Well, Cuban President Fidel Castro heard both supportive comments from his colleagues who condemned the U.S.-imposed economic embargo against Cuba in the summit's final declaration, as well as criticisms from several heads of state over Cuba's lack of political pluralism. Some foreign leaders held unprecedented meetings with dissidents just a few days before the summit. Meanwhile, Cuba has also just announced it is filing a lawsuit against the U.S. seeking more than $100 billion to compensate the Cuban people for suffering caused by the economic embargo, which has been in place for almost 40 years. At the same time, the United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly for the eighth straight year to demand the U.S. embargo be lifted immediately. We're joined right now by Jane Franklin, who is a historian on Cuba and author of the book Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History. In fact, excerpts of her book were used by the Cuban prosecutor who is pursuing the lawsuit against the United States. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jane Franklin.
Thank you, Amy, and good morning, Juan, and to all the listeners out there.
Well, it's good to have you with us, Jane. Why don't we start off by you explaining what the significance of the Ibero-American Summit is?
Well, the Ibero-American Summit at this point becomes part of the movement against the rampant rogue state activities of the United States within the World Trade Organization. It's interesting, Amy, that the Ibero-American conference was begun in 1991 after the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And it was an attempt, and is an attempt, by the Latin American, Spanish, and Portuguese-speaking countries, in addition to Portugal and Spain, to create a trade group in opposition to the United States, Canadian, and European groups, as well as the Asian powers. In other words, to have a power for Latin American peoples, but also with Spain and Portugal in there from Europe. So it's a very complicated mix. Each year that the Ibero-American Summit has met since 1991, every time that Fidel Castro went to the Ibero-American Summit, there was a great outcry from opponents of Cuba, the usual suspects. That culminated in 1997, as you remember, when there was an attempt, obviously, the trial has just begun of these people, to assassinate Fidel Castro as he landed at Margarita Island in Venezuela for the Ibero-American Summit that year. That trial is now taking place in Puerto Rico. But first time U.S. attempts to assassinate Castro are on trial. Now, at that summit meeting, though, the leaders of the Ibero-American countries voted to have this summit in 1999 in Cuba. Last year it was in Portugal. This year in Cuba, they always decide 2 years in advance. Immediately, the United States and the usual suspects in Miami and so forth began a campaign to try to stop this summit. It was reminiscent of their campaign to try to stop the summit of the non-aligned countries back in 1979.
Jane Franklin, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we're going to come back with you to talk about what's been happening in Cuba. Then we're going to talk about the Bhopal victims lawsuit against Union Carbide, and we'll be joined by Jesse Jackson Jr. to talk about an ad campaign, full-page ads in the New York Times this week, several of them, dealing with the issue of a moratorium on the death penalty, with a number of signers who are for the death penalty but are accepting that there need to be studies around the issue of race and class. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Jane Franklin. She is author of a chronology on Cuba and is talking to us about the Ibero-American summit that has just wrapped up in Cuba. Juan?
Well, Jane, Spain has been for decades now making enormous investments in many countries in Latin America and even in Cuba as well. Is it producing real economic benefits, or the whole relationship producing real economic benefits for Cuba and other Latin American countries?
Well, one, given the international situation, globalization is a fact of life, and we must deal with that and try to create a kind of globalization that does benefit the peoples of these many countries in the world. In fact, listening to the media or watching and reading the media in the United States right now, you would think that the main subject at the Ibero-American Summit was the Cuban dissidents. In fact, the main subject was exactly what you're talking about, and that kind of trade with Cuba. The extraterritoriality issue had been first brought up because primarily of the Helms-Burton Law, which is the law of this land, and it says that countries who trade with Cuba in lands confiscated from Cuban Americans who were not even Americans at the time, those countries can be sued and sanctioned. Now, of course, the other countries in the world object to this, and specifically Spain objects. Spain has a lot of investment in Cuba, and the Solmalia hotels are one of the targets of the Helms-Burton law at this point. There are continuous threats of sanctions. No sanctions yet, but threats. And Solmalia has at least 14 hotels in Cuba, which it manages. It doesn't own. Cuba owns the land under the hotels, and Solmalia manages those hotels. Now, one of the main things that came out of this Ibero-American summit, the final declaration, the Declaration of Havana, condemns specifically the Helms-Burton law. And I do think that that in itself is a major contribution, at least to Cuba at this point. The fact that Cuba was able to host all of these, there were 16 presidents in Cuba, plus the king and queen of Spain, plus two other presidents in observer status from Haiti and Suriname, from various other organizations. This is a major triumph for Cuban diplomacy, and it comes after the major triumph at the UN yet again, as Amy was saying before, the eighth year in a row that the UN has voted overwhelmingly against the Helms-Burton law, something that the United States would like to ignore. The United States tries to ignore the General Assembly. At the General Assembly, one of the most interesting, in fact, most important thing in that debate was Ricardo Alarcón. He's the president of the Cuban Parliament. His eloquent speech in which he said that the Cuban government is going to file suit in the international arena against the United States, as Amy also mentioned, for $181 billion in damages, deaths and injuries and economic damages. And they are filing this suit based on the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, adopted in 1948 by the United Nations. And he had a couple of things that really irrefutably condemned the United States in terms of genocide. He said that in a U.S. State Department memorandum dated June 24, 1959, that's 6 months after the revolution began, the State Department was talking about ending the sugar quota, which it did soon thereafter. And it says, the sugar industry, this is a quote, the sugar industry would promptly suffer an abrupt decline, causing widespread further unemployment. The large numbers of people thus forced out of work would begin to go hungry. And then he quotes another document on April 6, 1960, and approved that same day, that says it very explicitly, quote, every possible means should be undertaken promptly to weaken the economic life of Cuba, to bring about hunger, desperation, and the overthrow of government. And that is the essence of this 40-year state of siege against the Cuban government.
But Jane, I'd like to ask you on another subject related to this whole issue of genocide in general. Another subject of the summit, or at least raised a lot of eyebrows, was the fact that Chile and Argentina boycotted in protest of the arrest of Augusto Pinochet and the continuing case going on between Spain and England over his trial. But I'm sure a lot of people were surprised that Fidel Castro came out against the arrest of Pinochet. What was the reasoning behind that?
All of these countries voted unanimously against that law because they see it as a possible infringement, and in this case, real infringement of the laws of the countries involved. They are very concerned about the implications from this, what could happen in other countries. For instance, the Cuban-American community in Miami, the exile community that opposes Castro, that part of it which does, there are a lot who don't oppose him now, but those who do continually try to link him with crimes. They would like nothing better than to have the United States go in there under a law, which is also the law of this land, that the United States can go in and kidnap foreign leaders and get away with it, and put him on trial for crimes against them, against the very people who were running the dictatorship of Batista back in the 1950s. These people want to return to that era. And so there's some worry even about that kind of thing.
Finally, Jane Franklin, you mentioned the media making a lot of leaders at the Ibero summit meeting with dissidents in Cuba. But can you talk about that? More than a dozen Cuban human rights advocates and relatives of political prisoners holding meetings with dignitaries. I'm looking at the front page of the New York Times today. This is the only, you know, day after coverage of the summit called Forging Links in Cuba. And can you say who these people are in Cuba?
Well, they differ. Elizardo Sanchez, for instance, is an actual dissident. I would say he's probably for real. He's not paid by the Cuban American National Foundation or the United States Congress. Then there are others. Most of those people who met with these leaders of other countries fall into that category. Some of them don't. Some of them are paid by the Cuban American National Foundation and the Congress of this country. As Helms-Burton, the Helms-Burton law makes it law for our Congress here to send a certain amount of money, millions of dollars a year, to dissidents in Cuba. They have to do that by law. And so you can see that since there are not very many dissidents in Cuba, the money goes a long way. And these people make money on it. That's why Cuba says they're mercenaries. But Elizardo Sanchez really, he's more an indigenous dissident. The thing is that there were a lot of leaders down there that didn't meet with these dissidents, and they're not discussed. For instance, you have the Bolivian president, Banzer. He did not meet with them. He came to this meeting to basically oppose the embargo against Cuba and to try to get economic aid. The issue of debt relief was very important in the Ibero-American Conference, and Cuba, of course, has been a leader in that since back in the 80s, and they had a conference on debt in 1984 that set the standard for trying to get some kind of debt relief for the Third World. And Cuba's regarded as a leader among these people. And, for instance, the media doesn't mention the baseball game that's going to be played tomorrow between Venezuela, in which the Venezuelan president, Chavez, is going to be, I believe he's going to pitch for Venezuela, and Fidel Castro is going to manage the Cuban team, and I wouldn't be surprised if he gets out there with an opening pitch, but we'll see about that. But that's not mentioned. I mean, Venezuela, as Juan was saying earlier in the program, is conducting activities that upset the usual suspects in Washington. And he will also be a target, just as Cuba has become a target.
Well, Jane Franklin, I want to thank you very much for that sum up this day after the Ibero-American Summit, the first ever to take place in Cuba. Jane Franklin is the author of Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move now to another part of the world, but also its connection to the United States. It was the worst industrial accident in history, at least 7,000 dead, tens of thousands of others injured. It was the poison gas leak at the Union Carbide pesticide plant in Bhopal, India, in 1984. Survivors and relatives of the victims this week sued Union Carbide for, quote, depraved indifference to human life. The suit was filed in federal court in New York, and it also names the former chair of Union Carbide, Warren Anderson, as a defendant. The case seeks unspecified damages and wants the federal court to take back control of litigation that was first filed here against Union Carbide by the Indian government, but was moved to India in 1986. Although the Indian government's civil lawsuit against Union Carbide was settled in 1989 for close to $500 million, criminal charges against the defendants are still pending in India. The litigation against the company stems from the December 2, 1984 disaster that occurred in Bhopal when a tank leaked 5 tons of poisonous gas into the air. We're joined in the studio now by Curtis Trinko, who is co-lead counsel on the Bhopal case. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. How are you doing?
Very good. Can you explain what this case is about?
Well, this case attempts to remedy the human suffering and massive injury that has not been rectified by all of the efforts to date. This suit is brought on behalf of the victims of the disaster as well as their survivors, and it's brought under the Alien Tort Claims Act for violations of international law and of human rights. We do acknowledge that there was some monetary relief that was provided. Before Union Carbide became a fugitive from justice, one should understand that they sold all of their assets in India and fled the scene and became a fugitive. And now are taking the position that they are no longer subject to the criminal laws of the government of India. Therefore, we have brought a suit here under the Alien Tort Claims Act seeking relief for these victims because they cannot get relief in India. But the $470 million that was placed by Union Carbide into a fund was just a scratch of the surface with regard to the overall suffering of the population. And in fact, it's led to payments as low as $300 or $400 to people that lost individuals and their families. Much of it has gone for costs and other ancillary administrative expenses. Much of it has gone into the creation of a hospital that was mandated to be built within 18 months, but only opened in 1998, 14 years after the disaster. We are looking at, yes, the 7,000 people that died, the 50,000 people that were injured, but there were about 500,000 people that were contaminated by the disaster. And most of the relief effort to date has been focused upon those that needed medical treatment right away. But in terms of those that are partially disabled or fully disabled, there's very little effort being undertaken for job training or for some effort to make their life meaningful. Also, at the time, they did not include the minors, meaning anybody under 18 years of age was not really included in the statistics and were not really included in the relief effort. Yet all those people are now adults, and there's a great incidence of birth defects and of congenital defects because there was enormous genetic and chromosomal damage that was done. And that needs to be studied, and then efforts have to be taken to rectify that as well. In addition, there are now great clusters of different cancers that have developed and that need to be addressed in terms of preventative measures. There are other respiratory diseases that are breaking out in significant population that need to be dealt with. And also, as amazing as it seems, the site itself lies in the same state as it was in 1984. There has been no environmental cleanup undertaken. And in fact, an environmental assessment is now underway to both assess what contaminants are on site and what the cost will be. It is apparent from the initial findings that there was dumping of mercury and other contaminants on this site well before the disaster occurred. And it is so saturated, the site, with the soil and whatever, that it will take a massive environmental cleanup. And yet, it has just been left unattended.
Well, Curtis Trinko, I'd like to ask you, and we're talking about the 1984 disaster at Bhopal. I remember in 1989 reporting on the initial settlement and the uproar between the Indian government and the and Union Carbide, and the uproar among the Indian populace over that settlement. But could you explain how it was that Union Carbide sought to have this tried in India? Specifically so that it could reduce its exposure from American courts and then flouted Indian law?
Well, in the American lawsuit that was brought soon after the disaster, the Union Carbide argued under the doctrine of forum non convenience, which says that there was an alternative basis for adjudicating these disputes in India. In fact, that was not so. The Indian court system is so backlogged that it's very difficult to get anything done within a reasonable period of time. I believe that the Indian government, after the case was transferred, and I'm not faulting anyone, under the principles that were in effect at the time, the court made a decision and ruling that that was an appropriate way to handle it. But once it was transferred back to India, I think that the Indian Supreme Court attempted to adjudicate the thing, but it was just they just couldn't get on top of it. And the Indian government tried to cut a deal that they thought would be in the best interest of the population, although it was massively underestimating what the damages were.
Why can you bring this back into a U.S. court?
Well, we feel that as a fugitive from justice, Union Carbide never submitted and was never adjudicated under the criminal laws of India, and has now said that is not subject to their jurisdiction. Under the Alien Tort Claims Act, violations of international law and human rights can be adjudicated in a court in the United States on behalf of aliens from abroad. And so it's exactly the kind of situation.
We've seen this law used against dictators, human rights abusers. It was used against Avril, the dictator in Haiti. The Center for Constitutional Rights has pioneered these cases, used against the Indonesian general in charge of the Timor massacre, etc. But what about Warren Anderson? Do you expect to see him in court?
We fully expect to see him in court, and that he will have to answer these charges just as well as Union Carbide.
Warren Anderson, the former CEO of Union Carbide, when the Union Carbide plant blew up in Bhopal, India, and killed more than 7,000 people. I want to thank you very much, Curtis Trinko, for joining us, co-lead counsel in the Bhopal case, lawsuit filed this week in New York.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by the Reverend Jesse Jackson, by the Congressmember Jesse Jackson, Jr. Stay with us. Are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Texas prison guards wrestled a man to the death chamber yesterday after he refused to walk there on his own. 28-year-old Desmond Jennings was overpowered by a five-man team and dragged to the chamber, where he was strapped to a gurney and killed by lethal injection. He became the 29th person executed in Texas this year and the 193rd since the state resumed executions in 1982. Meanwhile, an investigation by the Chicago Tribune, published this past Sunday, revealed that capital punishment in Illinois is, quote, a system so riddled with faulty evidence, unscrupulous trial tactics, and legal incompetence that justice has been forsaken. Illinois has released seven people from death row in the past few years, including Anthony Porter, who came to within 48 hours of execution after evidence brought up after trial cast doubt on his guilt. Two prosecutors and two sheriff's deputies were tried last year for railroading a man and sending him to death row with fabricated evidence. Although the man, Rolando Cruz, was released after spending over a decade on death row, they were still acquitted of the charges. Well, the newspaper's findings come as thousands of supporters and opponents of the death penalty are calling for a moratorium on executions in several full-page ads that are running this week in the New York Times. The ads read, "Today's, to most politicians, this is an easy chair." And it's a picture of the electric chair. Illinois Congressmember Jesse Jackson collected the signatures, which include 19 members of Congress, several former prosecutors, 100 murder victims' family members, and a former Mississippi prison warden and the former president of the American Bar Association. They're calling for a moratorium to point out that capital punishment is applied almost exclusively to the poor and to evidence from the U.S. General Accounting Office showing racial disparities in sentencing and imposition of the death penalty. We're joined right now by Congressmember Jesse Jackson. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. It's good to be here this morning.
It's good to have you with us. Well, how tough was it to get your fellow Congressmembers to sign on to these ads?
Well, not that difficult. I expected it to be a lot tougher, but what it ended up happening was many members of Congress have recognized that technology is playing a significant role in the exoneration of some defendants on death row. Many of my colleagues are recognizing that while we are functioning under certain budget constraints here in Washington, that there is not adequate resources available for legal representation for indigent defendants. And so we're making a case in Washington amongst many members of Congress who are at least beginning to hear us.
Well, Congressman, some of the facts in today's ad are astounding, even to those people who think they're familiar with capital punishment. One of the facts that at least 381 homicide convictions have been overturned since 1963 because prosecutors concealed evidence of innocence or presented evidence they knew to be false. Given all of the problems that there are in the judicial system, though, you're still running against a current of that in across the country that still demands further crackdowns in crime and more prosecutions for capital murder. How do you expect to be able to make inroads into that prevailing trend?
Well, we simply tell people that we must balance justice with mercy. We must recognize that the advent of new technology, including DNA testing, for which I just filed a new bill in the House of Representatives, along with Senator Dick Durbin, to allow an exemption, if you will, for those criminal defendants who have been tried, but who are now insisting that they get an opportunity at DNA testing to find out if, in fact, they were at the crime scene and if there's any evidence that remains that could exonerate them based upon that fact. I suspect that will also take up momentum, but it's becoming increasingly clear that many politicians, and what I find so interesting about the signatures that we got for this particular ad, was all of them are running for public office again within the next year. And so they have not buckled this time to the climate of being soft on crime because they know they're fighting fundamentally for what is right and that we need to fundamentally slow the process down.
Perhaps what's most interesting about these ads and this call for moratorium is that a number of people who are for the death penalty are calling for the moratorium, like Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and Jack Curtin, who's the former president of the American Bar Association, which called for a moratorium on executions in 1997. Can you tell us, Jack Curtin, what your thoughts are as you are for capital punishment?
Well, my position on capital punishment is very limited. I'm not for the death penalty in all murder cases, only in cases in which there is an indication that there may actually be a deterrence because there is very limited evidence that capital punishment is a general deterrence to crimes such as murder. I'm hopeful that we will have the American Bar Association position extended to various states. The position is the position of the American Bar as a whole. It's the policy of the American Bar, and it is calls for a moratorium in part because of some of the information that is appearing in the Illinois papers now. But prior to the revelation that, as one of your participants said, was so astounding in terms of prosecutorial misconduct. There is simply a great deal of inability to properly defend the people accused. We had a case where a man was sentenced to die who was represented by a lawyer who fell asleep during the trial. And it took a number of times before they finally got that matter resolved properly. And in many instances, the numbers of people who have been released after serving years and years on death row and found to be innocent is growing, and hopefully those numbers will provide a basis for people who will say, well, maybe we're against the death penalty, maybe we're for the death penalty, but we better take a look at what's going on in these death penalty cases. Let's have a moratorium until we straighten it out.
Well, Jack Curtin, one of the other facts in today's ad, which another astounding fact, which says that a Kentucky study showed that 25% of death row inmates had been represented at trial by attorneys who were later disbarred or resigned to avoid disbarment. Now, having covered many trials over the years as a journalist, I'm aware of how difficult it is for indigent defendants to get adequate representation, especially in death penalty cases. Is this one of your big concerns, the level
absolutely.
Of defense
and
that people have gotten?
We had done a number of studies on the compensation system. While it is not universally true that the amount of compensation that the lawyer gets determines the quality of representation. It is clear that if you have compensation that's as low as $10 or $15 an hour, with a cap even on that, as there are in some states, that you're not going to get the kind of representation that will permit the kind of investigation, for example, that those Northwestern students did in the Anthony Porter case. There's simply not enough funds available, and if you don't get someone who's willing to do it on a pro bono basis, you will go to trial with a half-investigated, if that, case, and against prosecutors with resources much superior to the those of the indigent defendant and is an adequately compensated lawyer, and you're going to likely lose.
We're talking to Jack Curtin and Congressmember Jesse Jackson. Jack Curtin, former president of the American Bar Association, which has, as an organization, called for a moratorium on executions. Congressmember Jesse Jackson has led the campaign for the moratorium on executions in the United States. Two full-page ads in the New York Times this week calling for that moratorium. I wanted to ask Congressmember Jesse Jackson, also let our listeners know tomorrow we'll be joined by Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, who has just introduced a bill in the Senate calling for an end to federal death penalty, and we'll see where that's going to go. But Congressmember Jackson, we're talking about a Congress right now that has passed some of the most draconian crime, what they call crime legislation, in history. And among the passages in the last few years of legislation is the limitation of habeas corpus for death row prisoners, which will affect all sorts of prisoners, like one very well known on death row right now in Pennsylvania, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Obviously very, very problematic. And I think the strongest argument that we've been making against the death penalty is the fear that an innocent person might be put to death. And there are a number of cases where there's sufficient evidence to suggest, and certainly in Texas and certainly in other states where the penalty has been wantonly distributed, primarily based upon the indigency of the defendant. That is, they can't afford legitimate representation. Race continues to play a primary role in determining who the death penalty is offered for. And I've even called in a book that my father and I wrote called Legal Lynching for the imposition of life in prison without the possibility of parole in these cases until such time as those criminal defendants can prove either through technology that is constantly developing their innocence. If, in fact, that happens, that allows those of us who are political to still be tough on crime, whether you're a Democrat or Republican or liberal or conservative. You can be tough on crime. That is, no criminal defendant will be removed from prison. They are in their life in prison without the possibility of parole, while at the same time no innocent person is executed. So that allows a Democrat or Republican running for public office to be tough on crime, but at the same time not run the risk of executing an innocent person.
We'll let people know the phone number of the Moratorium Now campaign that you're helping to lead, Congressman Jackson. But before you go, we wanted to raise a few other issues that you've been involved with. One we wanted to ask you about is the sort of postmortem on the Hope for Africa Act, the bill that you were pushing for in Congress. And the other is the question of what's happening in Decatur right now. Your father, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, is spending the week there. The students remain expelled, even if the expulsion has now been brought from 2 years down to 1 year. You're a Illinois Congress member. What is your stand on this, and can you explain what happened?
Well, clearly, a horrible melee occurred at Eisenhower High School in Decatur, Illinois. The question is the proportional punishment for those young children. You have a school system of 10,000 kids, and in the last year, 1,700 of them have been suspended or expelled. What's happening with the children who are expelled is they're now sitting outside of the school. They're hanging around the neighborhoods. They're getting involved in things they should not be getting involved in, because there's not been adequate alternative schooling for children who've been suspended and or expelled from school. But 2 years suspension or expulsion for some of our young people is absolutely too much. Assuming that a child is 17 years old and is suspended or expelled for 2 years, that means they're 19 years old when they get the opportunity to return. That means they're probably 20 or 21 by the time that they graduate from high school. And so a two-year sentence amounts to a life sentence for many of our young people who simply can't recover after the level of punishment. And so I think Reverend Jackson has been leading a very valiant effort in Decatur, raising the questions of zero tolerance and whether or not that policy is one that we should enforce nationally. On the issue of the HOPE bill, we have worked and raised the standard of treating Africa the same way other nations around the country are treated when it comes to foreign policy. And what we did during that the course of that debate, when it first began 2 years ago, Congressman Rangel and others indicated that the trade, not aid, should be the direction that Africa was should be going in. But it became increasingly clear that workers were not protected, that the African environment was not protected, that there would be no sustainable growth in sub-Saharan Africa unless we deal with comprehensive debt relief. And so we have kept that debate alive. And now Maxine Waters and Barney Frank and others are moving a major piece of debt relief legislation through the Congress. My understanding there's already been a markup. And because, in part, because we've raised the bar and expectations of what we can do to change the dynamics in that part of the world.
And the administration's competing bill, what's happened with it now?
Well, you know, it passed the House, and it certainly passed the Senate just the other day. They have some hang-ups in the conference committee, at least that's my understanding, that there are some significant differences that still exist between the House version and the Senate version. But I will oppose that conference report because there are 750 million people in sub-Saharan Africa. And when you look at the language of this bill, it speaks primarily to Africa's economic elite, and it certainly speaks to the economic elite in our own country without providing the kind of protection for workers and the environment necessary for most Africans to benefit.
You know, we saw activists in the very early presidential campaigning of Al Gore actually score a major victory when it came to South Africa. While it may not be overall around the bill that you were pushing for, going and dogging Al Gore everywhere he went when he announced his campaign for the presidency, Gore Greed Kills, they were saying that he wasn't allowing companies in South Africa to make AIDS drugs, present them cheaply, offer them cheaply, when you're going to have something like a quarter of the population dead from AIDS.
Actually, the HOPE bill, my bill, had a compulsory licensing provision in it that would make it possible for those low-cost drugs to be made available on a wide scale to sub-Saharan Africans. The Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, the bill sponsored by Al Gore and the administration, had no such provisions and didn't even mention the word AIDS, which means the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act did not pay attention to the largest crisis on the continent. Showed how vulnerable the bill was to our criticism and how right our movement was. And so for those activists who challenged Al Gore, I believe they did the right thing because they certainly raised this issue to another level of understanding in our own country, and they should be applauded for that.
And he was forced to lay off a bit in South Africa. Reverend Jesse Congressmember Jesse Jackson, the phone number of the Moratorium Now campaign, if people want to get involved or sign on.
Well, I believe it's in the New York Times this morning. I actually don't have the number directly in front of me, but
actually, we've got it right here.
Excellent.
It's, let me look, 301-699-0042. That's 301-699-0042.
There's a five-part series also that has appeared in the Chicago Tribune. To this morning, I'm going to put four parts of that series. The fifth part will be in tomorrow's newspaper on my website at www.jessejacksonjr.org. And I'm encouraging your listeners to please come to our website and read this five-part series that the Chicago Tribune has done on the death penalty. It is a fascinating series.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Congressmember Jesse Jackson Jr., Congressmember from Chicago, Illinois, Democrat, also Jack Curtin, former president of the American Bar Association. And that does it for today's show. A special shout out to our affiliate in Chicago that runs Democracy Now!, WZRD. And also a reminder, we will be broadcasting live from Seattle for the week of the WTO Summit, and anyone, any station around the country can air our daily hour program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!